welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 7th of November 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason and plot. We've just had the bonfire night and the fireworks displays over the weekend, and it's the beginning of another week here in Radio Albion Land. And we're here today to discuss the week's news that is of interest to British nationalists. And who better to discuss that with than my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you. I'm doing very well, actually. Yes. You've been mentioning the sort of festivities around firework nights, etc. And one of the things that I've done this year that I haven't done before, and I've done it this year because my grandchildren are now of an age where they can sort of partake in this sort of thing. I collected a load of conkers and made some conkers, because children aren't allowed to play conkers at school anymore because apparently it's supposed to be highly dangerous. We harvested a load of conkers, drilled holes through them and stuck them on shoelaces, and we had a great time playing conkers.
I think we used to do things like soak them in vinegar and put them in the oven. I can't believe kids are not allowed to play conkers anymore. I mean, that was such a part of growing up within Britain with these conker trees and at this time of year. So they say that's too dangerous for the kids to play with, but it's not too dangerous to have all these people who we don't know who they are coming in on our beaches, up to 1,000 of them the other day, I believe, and the illegal immigration problem in Britain has been massively in the news over the last week, particularly with Suella Braverman referring to it as an invasion. And I did a podcast on the Daily Nationalist talking about that. But what seems to be mainly in the news at the moment is the Manston Centre. There are two centres where these fake refugees, I say fake refugees because they come from France and there is no war there. There are two centres that they end up being put up in before they get portioned out to hotels. One is called the Manston Centre and the other is called the Jetfoil Centre. And the Manston Centre has been in the news because of this petrol bomb attack last week, which we haven't yet discussed, and also because Suella Braverman visited there the other day. So, Max, I believe you've been looking into this. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Manston Centre and Suella Braverman's visit to begin with?
Yeah, I've looked at a couple of aspects of this. One of the things was that Suella Braverman made a speech in the Commons where she, for the first time, I think she's probably the first politician, national politician anyway, to have described what's going on the south coast as an invasion. And personally, I think that's an accurate word to use. I think if people are coming into your country by legal means and applying for asylum in the legal way, then that is people applying for asylum. They are asylum seekers. But when people climb onto boats or climb into boats and then travel across the sea between ourselves and the European mainland, and then arrive in the sort of numbers that are arriving now, I think that the record was something like about 1,200 in a single day, but it's been quite common over the course of the summer that we've had as many as 1,000 in a day, and I think that a movement of people who knows they're unwanted and who knows they shouldn't be allowed in the country, and that's why they do travel across the channel in boats, it's quite justifiable to describe that as an invasion. Not an armed invasion, but an invasion nonetheless. One of the interesting statistics, or in fact two interesting statistics, that Suella Braverman released while she was speaking in the Commons was, firstly, that there are, when she took over as Home Secretary, there were 35,000 migrants who had been put up in hotels, and that this was costing the government £6.8 million a day. Now, nobody from the media has thought to divide 6.8 million by 35,000 to see how much is being paid for their hotel rooms each evening. And it turns out that if you do that little bit of mathematics, it comes out at £194.28 per evening or per night, which I think is such an amount of money that These probably are very high-grade hotels that these people are being put up in. And I just find it remarkable that the government are spending those sorts of amounts of money. It's amazing, really, if you think about it. And if you take that £6.8 million per day and you multiply it by 365 days, it comes to £2.48 billion per annum.
Wow, for £2.8 billion on these refugees. And I did see a figure of £150 a night. So the fact that it's actually nearer £200 a night shows that £150 a night figure that they put out is there to cover up this £200 a night cost. I mean, we're going to end up with no room in the hotels for British people that need to stay in a hotel, because the hotels are all going to be filled up with these fake refugees. I mean, at the moment, they're trying to just hire out an entire hotel in order to put the refugees in them. But now they're saying, well, we can't do that because we've run out of hotels. Now we're going to have to start putting them in with paying customers. You imagine that. You're a paying customer and you've got to stay in a hotel. You go to stay in the hotel and it's full of these fake refugees, people with a completely different culture as us, leering at your daughter. And as you say, that they're fairly expensive hotels. They're going to be hotels with swimming pools, jacuzzis, hot tubs, all that sort of thing. And we wonder why these people are coming to our country. I mean, if they want to have a holiday, that's all they need to do is just come to Britain. They'll be put up in a hotel, and it doesn't end there. I mean, what happens after they're in the hotels? They end up being given social housing. So they end up being given social housing when we have Indigenous British people and just British citizens that should be housed first. But it's these refugees that go there. And first off, they go to this Manston Centre, which is apparently supposed to hold 1,600 people, I think. And at the moment, it has about 3,500 people in it. So the people have been complaining and saying to the Home Secretary, well, you've got far too many people in this Manston Centre. They're only supposed to be there for 24 hours and they're there for a month. And she's saying, oh, well, but we have been farming them out to these hotels, and people have been complaining that she's not getting them in hotels fast enough. Instead of complaining about the fact that they're being in hotels at all, there literally are complaints that she is not putting them in the hotels fast enough. Over the weekend, or just on Thursday or Friday last week, I think it was, she ended up going to the Manston Centre to see for herself. And she arrived in a helicopter because she also wanted to see the coastline that Britain's border force are supposed to be defending. I mean, the incredible thing about all of this is that we live on an island. It should be very, very easy to defend our island from people that are trying to break in to our property, basically. Because if you look at places like Poland, you look at places like Hungary, you know, they're landlocked. And yet they manage to prevent illegal immigrants from coming in. And they're a part of the European Union as well. And they get fined for doing this. We're not a part of the European Union. And yet for some reason, we just keep allowing these people in. We're actually taking more, we're accepting more asylum claims than anyone else in Europe. I mean, 75% of these asylum claims get accepted. The ones that don't get accepted, they don't get deported and they get to hang around. And a lot of the time when they get taken from the Manston Centre and they get put into these hotels, they then abscond because a lot of them have got family here. So they go off to live with their family. There's no restrictions on them for preventing them from coming out from this centre. We're in a really awkward situation here. And again, there are complaints that there's been scabies and these diseases at this centre because there's, you know, there's far too many people there. And of course, Suella Braverman is saying, well, we should be sending the ones that don't actually get asylum, we should be sending them to Rwanda. And I think she's trying to sort out some South American countries that they can be sent to as well. But no, still nobody has actually been sent off to Rwanda. They're still here in Britain. I mean, it is literally going to end up with, we don't actually have any rooms left in our hotels because they're all going to be filled up with illegal immigrants, I think. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I agree entirely with everything you said. When you think that all this is going on at a time when we're facing a cost of living crisis, where virtually every public service, whether it's the health service, whether it's the education service, whether it's the police service or whatever, or social services, they're all struggling. They're all very short of money. They're all facing cuts in their budgets for next year in order for us to to put right the black hole that exists in the nation's finances. And yet here we are spending £2.48 billion per annum putting people up in hotels who have no right to be in the country. And when they do get here, make all sorts of demands. They don't ask. They're demanding the correct standard of accommodation. And it's just entirely wrong that things should be that way around. You know, if we are facing a cost of living crisis where people's energy bills are going up to the extent that they are, where people's people are facing tax increases, where people are facing a reduction in their pensions and their benefits because the triple lock is likely to be done away with, and you know, in that situation, and again where we're facing inflation, which means that everything is costing more wherever you go, for us to be in a situation where we're expected then to be charitable, and not just charitable, but to be self-effacing and forelock tugging in the face of people who come over here with who feel entitled and who abuse, because Suella Braverman was booed when she visited the Manston Centre. You know, who then abuse the very politicians that are falling over themselves to try and accommodate the people that are coming, and it is just simply the fact that the sheer weight of numbers. I think, as Suella Braverman said in the House of Commons, she said that it's virtually impossible to just conjure 1,000 hotel rooms or 1,000 hotel beds out of nothing, and to have to do it, you know, continually, day after day after day during the summer, must just be an absolute nightmare for the people that are trying to arrange accommodation for these people. And
well, also a nightmare for the people that live in that area, that have their hotels filled up with these people. That's a huge problem as well. I mean, it also came out last week that the school plate, there's no places left in the schools. In Kent, I think it is, and Dover, where the majority of these people are coming in, there's no places left in the schools for British citizens because they're all being taken up by the so-called refugee children, who don't look like they're children at all. Of course, they look like they're much older. And we now have Indigenous British folk and British citizens that can't get school places for their children because they've been filled up with these newcomers. And also in these hotels, they're literally protesting because the food isn't good enough. There was a hotel outside Colchester the other day, and there was so-called refugees on the roof threatening to throw themselves off because the food wasn't good enough. And there was a very well-written letter, suspiciously well-written letter, that got thrown over the fence at this Manston Centre, talking about how terrible it was and what awful conditions that they're being put under. And of course, you know, they've broken in. It's the equivalent of somebody breaking into your house and demanding to have access to your fridge, access to your bedroom, access to everything that you have after breaking into your home. That's the thing that I don't get. You know, breaking into a country is the same as breaking into a home. Did you see any of these protests, Max? Oh, and of course, last year we had somebody that was stabbed up in Glasgow. We had these fake refugees were staying in a hotel. They weren't happy about the food. They weren't happy about the internet speed. So they went on a stabbing spree and they stabbed a load of people. I mean, so it's not like, you know, there is just this problem of all the money that's being spent. It's all the other problems that occur. I heard the other day there were two children that were raped at one of these hotels as well that are filled up with these immigrants. So again, so if you're going to put them in there with people that are just genuinely on holiday, British citizens, you know, there is the risk that some of these British citizens may end up being injured, you know, by the worst types out of these fake refugees. Did you see this protest, Max, outside Colchester? Did you hear anything about that?
I didn't see that protest, no, but I think you make a very valid point there. You know, we don't know who these migrants are. They're coming across the channel in boats, so they must be very determined people to do that sort of thing. And very often they're coming from war-torn countries initially, despite the fact they've come through several peaceful countries in order to get to us. But those that have come to us from war-torn countries, we don't know what they've been doing in their country. You know, war tends to make people have a greater disregard for law and order. And it's a well-known fact that wherever there has been mass immigration, and I often talk about the Wild West, wherever there's been mass immigration into a country of young men of military age, you always get a crime spree. And so it's not surprising that happens. That's happening here in the UK. There was a lady who was interviewed on television within the last couple of days, I can recall, who mentioned that she's got a house that's close to the coast, and that one night she had left her a window open, and a migrant had climbed through her window and had confronted her. And she'd asked him to leave, and he then asked if he could have her phone and if he could have food, I think. And she was just absolutely terrified, because she was an elderly woman, completely on her own. I think she did manage to call the police. When the police arrived, this guy was apparently going around her. Well, it was in her bedroom, rooting through her drawers and things, looking for anything that he might need. And so this is a terrible state of affairs, and it's exacerbated in the extreme respects that we've just been discussing, by virtue of the fact that the great numbers of people that are coming. And as you said earlier on, we are an island. It should be possible for us to have security. I'm not aware from any of the many histories that have been written of the Second World War that any substantial numbers of German soldiers managed to make it across the Channel in small boats. And so if we could stop armed German soldiers from coming across the Channel in small boats during the Second World War, why can't we stop people who are supposed to be migrants coming across the Channel in small boats? It must be possible for it to be done. It's just the fact that there isn't the will to do it. And quite often when people from the media interview people who've worked at the Home Office, what we see is that the people working at the Home Office who are responsible for administering the migration into the country, they are people who, sort of character-wise, are very similar to what was the character that Jean Le Mesurier played in the original Dad's Army. They're sort of dithering people who are so full of woke ideas that it's no wonder really that the immigration service and the border force, etc., are failing to control this thing.
Yeah, and we should have really learned from what was happening in Greece. I mean, I can recall there was a woman in Greece where these holding centres are, talking about exactly what you were saying there, Max, about how they're not safe in their own homes anymore. They've had to board them all up and get themselves weapons to protect themselves with, to defend themselves with, and it's the same on the French coast. And now we're hearing of similar things that are happening on the south coast, where these centres are. And last week there was somebody that threw a petrol bomb at the Manston Centre and then killed himself. And the guy had a lot of serious mental problems. But this is just the sort of thing that that shows you the strength of the feeling that there is against this. Of course, obviously, we condemn any violence, we condemn any attacks like that. It certainly doesn't help our cause in any way whatsoever. But that just gives you a measure of the strength of the public feeling that there is about this. And I think Suella Braverman, she understands the strength of public feeling that there is about this. And she talks a good talk, as if she really does want to do something about it. So we'll just have to wait and see whether she does do something about it. But we did have some good news as well last week. Rishi Sunak, our new Prime Minister, has apparently removed the clause from the online harms bill about legal but harmful content. And this was a clause that was put in there, and this was basically saying that internet companies would have to move content that was completely legal but was critical of government policy, or critical of government policy. And if they didn't do that, they would end up getting massive fines by the government. So instead of the government increasing the the limitations on our freedom of speech, what they were going to do is they were going to get the internet companies to increase the limitations on freedom of speech. So things that you could quite legally say offline would suddenly, you would not be able to say them online. And a lot of people were very concerned about this, about the censorship that it was bringing in. And a lot of free speech advocates were talking about this. And it seems Rishi Sunak has removed it. He's removed it from this bill. So the online harms bill is supposed to protect children from groomers. It's supposed to protect people's data. But then they also had this thing. It was supposed to protect adults from this legal but harmful content. That was the serious part of it. And it's been removed. I think this is really good news. This is very, very, very positive. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, I think the expressed intention of protecting adults from things that are legal but harmful. It's another unacceptable face of the nanny state, basically, who are treating adults in this country as if they're people who can't differentiate between what is right and what is wrong. We don't need a nanny state to do that for us. We're people who have existed for thousands of years, and all sorts of ideas get discussed by people. We don't need a government department to decide what is appropriate to be said in public and what is not appropriate to be said in public. I'm completely against any restrictions on freedom of speech. I think people should be allowed to say what they want. Obviously, if they say it in a way which is aggressive and which is intended to intimidate somebody and so it constitutes harassment, then that should be illegal. But where somebody is just simply expressing a point of view which isn't wishing harm on anybody else or trying to encourage other people to commit criminal acts, then that should be allowed.
Yeah, who is it that decides what's harmful then? You know, that's why we have the law. We have the law which outlines what speech is legal and what speech isn't legal. But to then have somebody else saying, oh, well, no, even though this is completely legal, we think it's harmful, which is basically saying we don't want people to hear this speech. We don't want you to hear this speech. We don't want you to learn these facts, basically. So I'm very, very pleased that Rishi Sunak has removed that clause. And there's also a bill that's being put through Parliament to prevent banks from removing people from their banking services for their political views. Now, some people have pointed out, well, when the banks remove their services from somebody, they don't actually say, we're removing this because of your political views. They don't actually tell the banking customer the reason why the bank have removed their facilities. And they just say, we're within our rights to remove the facilities, and we don't actually have to tell you the reason why. And of course, it's only nationalist activists and speakers and content creators that end up having their bank accounts removed. And I think what this would mean, if this does actually go through Parliament, it means that if you do get your bank account removed, then what you could say is, you could say, well, the bank have done that for my political views, and they have to prove that they haven't done it for your political views. So I think this could actually bring in some protections, because the bank would then have to say another reason, wouldn't they? Even though they haven't put out, they could remove the facilities from somebody and they wouldn't actually say the reason for that. But if you then take them to court over it and say, look, I'm a prominent nationalist activist, my bank account was removed, they didn't tell me why, my suspicion is it was for my political views, and you have this law on the books saying that banks can't do this for people's political views, then surely the bank would then have to explain a reason why they took the banking facilities away other than political views, which they wouldn't be able to do, would they? They wouldn't be able to say, well, this person ended up getting themselves into a lot of debt or what have you. You know, they've got no excuse for doing it. So I do think that this could help. And it's come about because of the debanking of Toby Young and the Free Speech Union, and also this other organization that was campaigning to have schools kept open during the COVID times, and PayPal removed both of their banking facilities. So it's to do with PayPal doing this. So I think this could be a good idea. More and more people are losing their bank accounts. I think even Donald Trump lost his bank account. Kanye West, He had his bank account taken away from him. And it's quite obvious that the reasons for that happening is because of freedom of speech issues. So this could be very positive. I just read this the other day, Max. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you've said. Somebody who has had two bank accounts closed in the way that you describe, where I just get a letter from the bank saying, we're closing your account on such and such a day. We're not telling you why, basically. And then when I've inquired, they've refused to say why they're closing the account. They just do close the accounts. I have also found that sometimes they in closing the account, because they feel that you are the sort of person that they wouldn't want to have as a customer of theirs. And in order to perhaps, I don't know what their rationale is for doing it, in order to prevent you from being able to annoy other banks, they then give you a poor credit rating. So when you go to another bank in order to open up a fresh bank account, you find that you can't open a fresh bank account because your credit rating has been damaged. And so it is very welcoming that a law is being brought in order to prevent this. I mean, the fact of the matter is that it's the left and the extreme left and the anti-fascists that are the aggressors in this situation. They're the ones who attack meetings by nationalists. They're the ones who telephone the hotels and try and intimidate the hotel staff. They're the ones that pose a threat and that try to dox people who are nationalist activists or nationalist leaders, and all this is part of the same process that's been building up over the years, where we're living in an increasingly Orwellian kind of situation, and so it's good that the pendulum seems to be beginning to swing back the other way, because it swung far too far into the realm of creating a totalitarian society, where you have to believe the party line. You have to believe. You have to. You're not allowed to express any views critical of the party line. Because if you do, you will then face opprobrium, and you will face having your resources and having your bank accounts and your job placed under threat and all this sort of thing. So it is good that laws are being introduced, or this law is being introduced. And it's interesting, really, that it's actually politicians from an ethnic minority background that are actually the ones that are pushing for these safeguards to be introduced. And I've always said all along, there are lots of people from immigrant backgrounds who came to Britain because they liked Britain. They didn't come to Britain because they wanted to pull down our statues and because they wanted to wreck our country. They came to Britain because they liked Britain the way it was, the way it used to be, when there was a far more sensible government. And so it's interesting that perhaps the politicians that are now starting to allow the pendulum to swing back are people who one might ostensibly thought would have been wanting to implement measures to combat the our freedom to express our views, or to deny us our freedom to express our views. And so it's quite a refreshing thing.
Well, certainly good news. I mean, we have people in Patriotic Alternative that are, like you were suggesting there, Max, people that are of different ethnicities that have come to Britain, and they want to see the British way of life preserved because of that, because they like to see the British way of life. And then, as you say, there are people that actually come to Britain because of that reason, not because they want to pull down the statues. And I also think that when you have people like that that are politicians, that they can get away with saying things that white people can't. You know, things like if a white person was to say that, they would get accused of racism. I mean, if somebody, if a white politician had used the terminology that Suella Braverman did last week, they would almost certainly be accused of being a racist and using hostile language. But of course, the fact that Suella Braverman is of Indian ethnicity, it means that she can't possibly be accused of being a racist. So she can say these things. It's similar with Kemi Badenoch, when she can talk about how schools should not be promoting Black Lives Matter and schools should not be promoting the idea of white privilege. You know, again, if a white person was to be saying that, then they run the risk of being accused of being a racist. So I'm very happy that we've got these non-whites that are actually talking sensible issues, sensible things. We've also got Kanye West over there in America. Who is basically demonstrating to everyone that what he is talking about is actually what is happening. You know, the people that he is criticizing and saying, well, because you criticize these people, that's when you end up losing your bank account. That's when you end up losing your social media. And then straight away, he loses his bank account. He loses his social media. He loses his contracts. I mean, he's just demonstrating this. So I'm very glad that we have non-whites that are pointing these things out. We've got another bit of interesting news, another bit of good news that happened last week, and this is very surprising actually. It's Rosie Cooper, the Labour MP, who has spoken out against Hope Not Hate. I mean, this is just a sample of the headlines. I have been used as a marketing tool, furious Labour MP Rosie Cooper accuses ITV. That's from the Daily Mail. The Daily Mirror, Labour MP criticises stupid ITV show dramatising neo-Nazi plot to kill her. And then we have Deadline.com, a stupid, stupid, stupid series. Labour MP lambasts ITV drama, The Walk in Parliament. And she actually got this put into the Hansard questions in Parliament. She asked for permission to actually state this in the House of Commons. And she said that Hope Not Hate and ITV have been using her to try and sell this series. Obviously, it was very traumatizing for her when this happened. So she's reliving the trauma. She said that when she had to go to the court over this, the court case, if listeners will remember, an ex-National Action member was accused of plotting to kill Rosie Cooper, and he pled guilty to it. And she went to court, and she said that when she went to court, she was being chased by the ITV cameraman. She's absolutely disgusted at ITV. She's disgusted at Hope Not Hate for turning, you know, what was a serious threat to her life, for turning that into entertainment, or what felt to her like a very serious threat to her life. They've turned that into entertainment. She's disgusted at it. She says that all the money that's made from this should be sent to the Joe Cox Foundation. So really, really surprising to see Rosie Cooper actually criticizing Hope Not Hate. So, I mean, three good bits of news there last week. The show that she's actually talking about is called The Walk-In. I don't know if you've seen that, Max, or you've got any views on what we just talked about there.
Yeah, I have watched The Walk-In. It's not a particularly interesting story. What I would say, though, from Rosie Cooper's point of view, is that she would not want to have all this issue raked over again, because it refocuses attention on her. And the people who've made The Walk-In and Hope Not Hate, they try to give the impression that the country's under dire threat because that there are all these neo-Nazi types that are just dying to kill somebody. And so poor Rosie Cooper has been suddenly thrust into the spotlight again, and she probably is quite worried that there might be some random member of National Action that hasn't yet been picked up by the police or whatever, hasn't yet been neutralized by the special services, and who's still harboring the same desire to kill her, and so she's probably now walking the streets with far greater trepidation and fear. And that trepidation and fear has not been caused by anything that any serious nationalist has done. It's been done by Hope Not Hate and ITV, just fairly recklessly, really, creating sensational advertisements and trailers in order to promote what is a fairly boring series, really.
Yeah, you end up feeling very sorry for her. I mean, she must have been very frightened about this when it occurred. I mean, she's just a sweet little old lady, basically, and it must have been terrifying for her. And now it's all being dragged up again. And she's probably scared that it's actually making her a target for the people that she imagines wants to kill her. I mean, it must be quite horrible for her to, think that there was somebody out there that literally planned and plotted to kill her, and now that's being turned into entertainment, and it's dragging it all up again for her. Yeah, so I think she's resigning as well as Labour MP. I have a lot of sympathy for her, basically. She just looks like a sweet little old lady to me. Shall we move into our eugenics presentation then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Right, we'll start with the Eugenics Society. The Eugenics Education Society, renamed the Eugenics Society in 1926, was founded in London in 1907, due largely to the efforts of social hygienist Sybil Gotto, later to be called Neville Rolfe. The elderly Francis Galton became its honorary president, and the society sought to promote the study of agencies under social control that may improve or impair the racial qualities of future generations, either physically or mentally, and to intervene whenever a proposed administrative act appears likely to impair the racial qualities of the nation. Pearson declined to join because it was not a scientific organisation. Well, I mean, there's loads that we could get into in this. So they're looking at social programmes and how that might actually affect the quality of the people. So if you have a social program that rewards people for not working, rewards people who don't really contribute much to the nation for producing lots of children, then that's going to have a negative effect on the quality of the people. This is effectively what we have today. People that stay together that are married, I mean, that's obviously the best foundations for a child to be brought up in. People are not encouraged to do that anymore. They get more benefits money, they get more income if they end up splitting up, if they end up living separately, for instance. So that's one thing that has caused dysgenics. We also, as I say, we also have this rewarding of people that don't actually contribute very much to society. And they will get the house paid for if they're a single mother or what have you. Again, it's not the best environment for the child to be brought up in. So I would suggest that these might be some of these agencies under social control that might impair the racial qualities of future generations. So rather than looking at things scientifically, they were looking at these policies. I mean, really, we should have somebody that looks at government policy and says whether that's going to be positive or negative for the indigenous British people. You know, is it going to be good for the British people to bring lots of people over from other countries? Again, today's immigration policy and the promotion of multiculturalism, that's not going to be no good for the racial qualities of the future generations, because the racial qualities could be mixed race qualities where the newcomers have come in and interbred with the indigenous British. And the offspring is then not indigenous British anymore, and it's not really the same as the newcomer that came in. So that's impairing the racial qualities of the nation, because it is introducing different genetics into it. So the nation is no longer the nation. So that would, again, that would be a risk. But people can't do that. We don't have anybody that speaks up for the indigenous British people. But we do have these advocacy groups for these other groups. If a policy is brought in and the Muslims think that it's not going to be any good for Muslims, that they have community leaders that will point this out. The same for Jews, the same for blacks. I mean, most ethnic groups have advocacy groups for them, but we have no white advocacy groups speaking up for us. So I think this was a very good idea, a very foresighted of them to look at the sort of social programs that were being brought in, and were they going to improve the racial qualities or were they going to impair the racial qualities? And I would say things such as public schooling, everybody being given a schooling, that's probably likely to increase the racial qualities, or it's certainly going to improve the intelligence and the skill set of the people that are here. Would that actually improve the biological qualities, the racial qualities? I'm not sure. But I certainly think this was a good idea. What are your thoughts on this, Max?
Well, my thoughts are basically that eugenics is a very sound idea, and it's something that should be considered constantly, I think, and great emphasis and great importance should be placed upon the eugenic effect of any social programs or any measures that are introduced or any legislation that's introduced. It's interesting that very often when we try to be kind, we end up actually being cruel. And whilst I'm not suggesting that we ought to be crueler to people, we do need to have an eye on the dysgenic effect of our acts of kindness that our acts of kindness sometimes produce as an unforeseen consequence of them being implemented. For example, the National Health Service exists, and I've got great support for the idea of the National Health Service. But as years have gone by and the National Health Service have benefited from research that's been done by various doctors and medical institutes, etc., both in this country and around the world, what's happened is that the treatments that are available to people now are better than the treatments that used to be available when the National Health Service was first introduced in, I think, 1948. And the point is that where these treatments improve and where they enable people who have got perhaps a congenital illness that would in previous generations have never been cured, the people are cured, or at least they're able to live a full life, which means that they then go on to have children, which means that those children will carry the genes. Insofar as the condition the person suffered from to begin with was genetic, they carry those genes on into future generations, where in previous generations that wouldn't have happened because the person who had that particular defective gene or whatever will have died. And as I say, there's no desire, I don't think, on our part to deny people treatment, but there has to be some thought given to what we can do to ensure that where there is a genetic component to a disease, that because we've been able to enable people with a defective gene to survive, that we need also to take some measures to make sure that those genes don't get passed on into future generations. What I see here is that gene manipulation is something that is that could possibly help to a tremendous extent in this situation, where we can use advances in medicine to enable people who've got a defective gene that otherwise would cause them to die young, that enables them to lead a full life. But at the same time, if there was some way of gene editing to take out the defective gene, so that future generations created by the person that then survives won't also carry that defective gene. If that sort of a situation could be arrived at, that would be highly beneficial in my view.
Yeah, that's one of the drawbacks to medicine, isn't it? You know, there are far more people survive to adulthood and actually being able to breathe than used to 150 years ago. So you end up with people that are weaker, that have weaker immune systems. Maybe they're more short-sighted. Maybe they have these congenital defects. And years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, they may not have made it out of childhood. So they may not have got to the stage where they could actually breed. And yet with the advances in medical science that we have now, they make it to adulthood and they end up breeding. And you end up with more people with weak constitutions as a part of the nation. So that's sort of has a negative effect. It impairs the racial hygiene of the nation. I'm trying to think of some ways that would improve the racial hygiene. of the nation that would encourage us to produce more geniuses. I guess a way to do that would be to have social programs that when you had people that have university degrees or diplomas or professors or doctors, to give them cash incentives to produce lots of children, to breed with somebody else that's of equal intelligence, and give them tax breaks, encourage them to produce children. A similar way to do this would be to get great sportsmen, people that are very good at athletic pursuits, and encouraging them, again, with tax breaks. What you could do is you could have a program so that the children of these gifted children, because they would be gifted if they came from gifted parents, you could set up special schools for them. I guess that would be a social policy that would improve this. Things like grammar schools. That's something that would improve the quality of the nation, I think. All right, would that improve the racial hygiene of the nation? Or I guess it certainly would with getting them to breed together. But just setting up grammar schools, I mean, that's going to improve the chances of the young people in the nation. But I guess that maybe that did encourage people to produce children. More intelligent types to produce children because they know that they've got a chance of going to a good school. So, you know,
I've got an open mind where it comes to, you know, whether grammar schools are better than other schools. I think that there are other factors involved rather than just the structure of the school. But what I would say is that by encouraging gifted people, whatever area of gift they've got, by encouraging gifted people to have larger than average families and to certainly have more children than just the replacement rate, that is the way to that must be the main plank of any eugenic program that's aimed at upgrading year by year, generation by generation, the genetic quality of our people. And if we were to do that, and if it could be done in such a way that, because we've spoken about this before, if that could be implemented, and at the same time, a program could be implemented where people who've got the less desirable genes were encouraged to have possibly just one child rather than having children at a replacement rate, then there would be a marked improvement that you'd probably be able to see in as few as 5 years in terms of the reduction in the number of people needing to use the National Health Service, for example. If a gene is found that contributes towards, I think there are genes that have been discovered that contribute towards breast cancer, for example, and if it was possible through gene editing to eliminate those genes in people that have got them, or if the people that have got the genes chose simply just to have one child instead of having several, then what it would mean is that as each successive generation passed, the people carrying that undesirable gene or that defective gene, however you want to view it, would become fewer and fewer, and more of the people who were able to be able to have that gene removed through genetic gene editing or something of that sort, greater numbers of those would survive. But the proportion within the society of people who don't have that undesirable gene would grow and grow and grow until the number of people within our society that do have it would be almost indiscernible.
Yeah, I think another policy was arranged marriage. I think arranged marriage was good. That would improve the quality of the race. And there was a saying years ago, I think, that if you allow women to choose who they want to marry, they will run off with a stable boy. But if you've got arranged marriage and women have to marry who they're told to marry by their parents, the parents are going to find somebody of an equal social rank for the woman to marry. So I think that was a positive eugenic policy. And then once you say, well, women can marry whoever they want to marry, then that's probably a dysgenic policy. Although some others would say, well, women will always try to marry up, but what they consider to be marrying up may not be actually marrying up. You know, maybe based on handsomeness, maybe based on a connection with the person, rather than it being based on the fact that they're from the same social strata or the particularly intelligent. I mean, the particularly intelligent types might not be the particularly good looking types. So I think that's another one. There is another social policy that affects the improvement of the race or the impairment of the race. getting back.
I think we should avoid using social rank as being something, because that kind of smacks of snobbery, perhaps, and we could be accused of being social snobs. I think that a system needs to be introduced which inculcates in the minds of young people the desire to marry well and to find a match that suits them. Now, it could be that the stable boy might actually have been, by sheer chance, might actually have received genes that make him a particularly splendid chap, whether it's, you know, through his looks or whether it turns out to be through his intelligence or whatever. And it may be that he would, from a purely genetic point of view, if you compared him with the daughter of the household, then he might actually be an ideal match. And if that's the case, then I think that her running off with him whilst running away from your parents isn't something to be encouraged. You know, her pairing up with him would be something that could be possibly desirable. But the point is, I think that the church really have missed a trick here, in that the church could, in days gone by, when if somebody was a minister of the church, then they would have a flock of people who would be regular attendees at church at the weekend, and where the, if the vicar was to provide proper pastoral care, rather than just popping around and having a cup of tea with Mrs. Vincent down the end of the road, if he was engaged or she was engaged in proper pastoral care, where the minister would go to a school and would become acquainted with the children that were passing through that school, and would be responsible for gauging and engaging with the school in gauging the quality of the children and the quality of individual children, then and that could be something where the pastoral care could extend to helping to select the right people and to put the right girls and boys together so that it had produced the most beneficial effect. Or it could be a matter of that pastoral care being that if a minister found that there was a couple who'd got, I don't know, let's say three children, and those three children were of particularly high quality, but the family was struggling because the father, through some sort of accident of life, and the mother or whatever, weren't able to earn sufficient money to enable them to live without claiming benefits or something of that sort, then the pastoral care that the minister would administer to his flock should also incorporate directing greater social support to families of that sort, so that where there is a family that is struggling financially, but where the children are of good quality and have got lots of desirable characteristics, where that family could prosper and benefit from the receipt of that assistance. And that in itself would upgrade future generations as well. So what we need is proper pastoral care. Because what happens nowadays, when you speak to people who are in need of social services or in need of some kind of social benefit, very often people talk about falling down between the cracks, because they're the sort of person who actually for whom it would benefit them to receive some assistance, and who it would very often benefit society if they were able to receive some assistance. But they don't get the assistance because there is the public services in this country are compartmentalized into little into compartments where it's very easy to fall, as the saying goes, between the cracks and get missed and not get the help and assistance that you need.
Yeah, I think the church did actually help out with the eugenics policy. I've actually just been doing some research for Patriotic History, looking at Augustine when he came to convert the Saxons. And one of the things that Augustine did was to write to the Pope and say, how close is it that people can be to get married? And he prevented cousins from marrying. I think he said it's second cousins are okay, or third cousins are okay. And obviously that's going to prevent there being the inbreeding and problems. And you get the opposite thing that happened with Islam. And they said, well, how close is it that we can marry in Islam? And they said, well, it's okay to marry your cousins. So amongst Islam, particularly in Pakistan, you get a lot of cousin marriages, which have ended up resulting in a lot of people with congenital defects, quite a few of them. And, you know, you end up feeling very sorry for them, because, like, the more children they have, the more disabled children they effectively have, because their religion encourages this marriage between them, which is too close genetically. Thankfully, with Christianity, the church said, you can't do that. We don't want to encourage that. So there was a policy that the church came up with that did actually help improve the quality of the people that were Christian. Getting back to our notes here, for some eugenicists, such ideas continued to have a strong racial element through which to control non-white populations in favour of Northern European races. However, the Eugenics Education Society was increasingly more concerned with curing, and that's their quote there, a variety of social and physical disorders or traits among the poor. These included alcoholism, habitual criminality, reliance on welfare, prostitution, diseases such as syphilis and tuberculosis, neurological disorders such as epilepsy, mental conditions such as insanity, hysteria, and melancholia, and feeble-mindedness, a catch-all term for people who are believed to lack mental capacity and moral judgment. I mean, looking at that, I mean, who wouldn't want to help people out so that they didn't have a predisposition towards being an alcoholic or a habitual criminal or being a prostitute or having syphilis or tuberculosis? I mean, the motives behind this were very positive, and this was more what they were doing, was trying to just improve the lives of the next generation. It's all thinking ahead of others, really, instead of thinking of yourself, because obviously eugenics isn't going to help you. But if the generation before you had been following these eugenics policies, then you would have been born into a body that was not likely to be feeble-minded, that was not likely to end up not being able to provide for yourself and having to rely on welfare. I'm interested that they see that prostitution here is also something that they thought was hereditary. And all of these instances here, there must have been some evidence to show that they were hereditary. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been doing this, because remember, they were using statistics at the time. And that's what Carl Pearson was doing, was all these statistics and all these measurements. So there must have been evidence to show that things such as being a prostitute, habitual criminality, alcoholism, all of these things actually passed down. There were traits that were passed down from parents to child. So they were trying to reduce these. And this was more important to them than controlling the racial element. I mean, they say here, eugenic ideas through which to control non-white populations. Well, there wasn't a non-white population that was living in Britain at this time, certainly not a non-white population of any size. Britain was 99.9% white, I think, until after the Second World War. And what we're talking about here is round about the time just after the First World War. So there really wasn't a non-white population that was in Britain. I guess around about this time, maybe birth control came in, and maybe they would try to use that in Africa. But I think what they're talking about here is non-white populations that are living amongst the white population. There wasn't one in Britain. There was one in America. And I think there were eugenics policies that were used in America with the black population, but I certainly don't think that there was one over here in Britain. What are your thoughts, Max?
I think you're right in that respect. I think that in previous generations, proponents of eugenics didn't focus too greatly on the issue of race, because race wasn't an issue in the interwar period in this country. Race wasn't an issue. There weren't significant numbers of non-whites living in Britain, and that would have been the reason for it. And so the focus was on things that were considered to be either socially transmitted or genetically transmitted. And I think that some of the things that you've mentioned there, like prostitution and habitual criminality, they are probably, and there is a greater social component there that causes criminality to run in families, and that causes prostitution to run in families. But there certainly would be to some extent as well genetic factors that would make somebody more predisposed. And I think that where there has been intelligence testing of people in prisons, that it's been shown that the prison population of the UK and the prison population of USA or any other country, generally speaking, has a significantly lower average intelligence than the wider non-criminal population. And so having low intelligence is something which means that you will be likely to be less successful in life. And so therefore, because you will have less and you'll see other people having more than you, the temptation for you to steal from them becomes greater. And that's why habitual criminality tends to run in families, and where you have crime families effectively, and where prostitution similarly runs in families. And other neurological disorders that you mentioned, and epilepsy. Epilepsy can be transmitted as a result of genetics, but it can also occur as a result of somebody sustaining serious head injury. So having epilepsy doesn't necessarily mean that you that you will genetically pass less welcome genes on into future generations. Feeble-mindedness, I think, we've touched on that. If somebody is feeble-minded, then they will tend to be less successful in life. They will tend to that they will underachieve academically, and so therefore not qualify for the sort of jobs that they'd want to have. They will tend to be easily duped by other criminals, which will then mean that they will have even less. And so therefore, as they look around them and they see that people who don't suffer from the same feeble-mindedness have got lots of things that they would like to have, but they can't have because they haven't got the money, then the propensity for them to steal will increase as well. And so, these things that you've mentioned, I think all of them can be addressed in some way through a eugenics program to improve the situation, to disrupt the transmission of socially transmitted maladies, and to gradually through the use of medicine and hopefully gene editing in the future to reduce the transmission genetically of undesirable traits.
Yeah, like so much of this, it's the nature nurture debate, isn't it? How much of it is nature and how much of it is nurture? How much of it is socially transmitted? How much of it is passed down hereditarily? And of course, at this time we're talking about here in the 1920s, they didn't have the understanding of genetics that we have today. So I'd say today they could be far more accurate with this. I mean, they could be testing people, they could be testing different generations, and they could say, well, this gene we have discovered only occurs in people with alcoholism, or mainly occurs in people with alcoholism. This appears to be a gene that is associated with it. So you could do those tests today and come out with this, and you could really sort of hone it down, this nature-nurture argument, and work out, you know, whether it was far more likely to be nature or far more likely to be nurture. And I guess they didn't have that technology. They didn't understand DNA back then in the 1920s, but they must have had statistics to show that this was intergenerational. So it must have been the debate that they were having at the time. How much of this is nature? How much of it is nurture? I think with intelligence, it's something like 60 or 70% is nature and 30% is nurture. And the older you get, the more it becomes hereditary, because there, a certain amount of intelligence can be adapted through education. And then the older you get, the more you turn into your parents. I mean, that's just something that everybody knows. That, you know, you turn to 40, you look in the mirror, you look just like your dad. You end up having exactly the same viewpoints that your dad had, you know. And that is, that's because it's the hereditary component that is showing more than the education component. The nurture component. So the older you become, the more the way that you do things is associated with your inheritance rather than the way that you've actually been taught. And I do find that it's interesting that this goes back to, you know, this old wives' tale that, you know, you get to 40 and you look in the mirror and you look just like your father. And I think it's the same with the racial aspect as well. The older you get, the more you become an example of your race rather than an example of how you were educated. I mean, that would just stand to reason, wouldn't it? Because the race and the nation is just the extended family. So the older you get, the more you become an example of your people rather than an example of the upbringing that you had. Any thoughts on
that?
There's
also a factor that babies have got certain, of whichever race, have certain characteristics that are, I think they're called, it's what's called neoteny, which is where you have the physical features of a baby, which tends to be, you know, big eyes, a fairly sort of bulging forehead, and I can't think what the other traits of neoteny are now, but all babies, including baby animals, have these the baby traits, because it makes them appear to be more attractive and makes them appear to be cuter. And so if you discovered a baby that has been deserted by its mother, or that where its mother has been killed and it's just been left to fend for itself, if you come across a baby, you're more likely to care for the baby, because the baby, whilst it's a baby, will look more like a generalized baby, and so therefore look more like one of your babies, so you'll care for it. But then as it gets older, the neotenous characteristics diminish, and the characteristics of old age start to come to the fore, and so therefore you start to look more like your racial ancestors.
Yeah, it's fascinating the way that it all works and how it ties in here with eugenics. I'm really enjoying these eugenics conversations that we're having here, Max. I think we should probably leave that here for today, though. So thank you very much for coming on today.
That's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.